Next, I'd like to welcome Dr. Naji Aboumrad. He's the Chair Emeritus of the Department of Surgery at Vanderbilt University, and he's going to talk about using science to replace surgery, evolving field of metabolic devices.
Thank you very much. You've heard a lot about the value of bariatric surgery and some of the mechanisms, and some of the giants in that field are already on the podium here. Let me start with a conflict of interest. I do firmly believe that if there is no conflict, there is no interest. I am not a bariatric surgeon, therefore I'm not here to tell you about the qualifications and the improvements. And I do have a conflict of a company which I co-founded with a colleague of mine called Metabolic Technologies, Inc. It's in Ames, Iowa. The problem where I live in Nashville, Tennessee, is a serious problem. This is Tennessee, the adult obesity rate up to 2017, close to 500,000 people, and only 2,200, maybe 2,300 bariatric procedures were done. The problem is even much worse when you look at the ranking in adult type 2 diabetes. It is now 13.1%. We are sixth in the nation. We were fourth 2 years ago. We did not improve. The others got worse. And there are close to 900,000 type 2 diabetics in the state of Tennessee, estimated to be around 1.4 million. So if you take the state, I mean, the numbers become much more important when they hit you in the face and figure out what's going on. And you've heard about the commonly performed bariatric procedures in the United States. And the only thing I'm going to talk about, the various other non-surgical procedures, alternative approaches, are the developments of balloons and various, some of these have been approved by the FDA, and ladies and gentlemen, I am not the right person to discuss these. So I'm going to move on to work which was significantly spearheaded by Randy Seely's group, not really sure if he's still working on it in Michigan, but when he was in Cincinnati, he published extensively, and focusing on this area of the gallbladder and the bile acids. And around 5 years ago, this young resident at Vanderbilt, Vance Alba, looked, we had a series of patients that we've been following over a period of several years, up to 8 years now. And we had samples of blood and we looked at their bile acids. At that time, there were three other publications in random findings that bile acids were elevated, but these were longitudinal observations. And you could see that in the obese subjects we had, the obese had lower than lean total bile acids, and they improved or increased significantly. And more importantly, in the insulin-sensitizing bile acids such as ursodeoxycholic acid. So this got, we got interested. Bile acids, as you know, can be detergents. They are extremely important in fat absorption, but they are also signaling molecules. And one of the areas that has been alluded to but not terribly studied, and for young people in the audience who want to proceed further, I would suggest that you look into this area, is the role of bile acids in fat absorption after bariatric procedures. This is what happens with folic acid. It's usually converted primarily in the liver from chinodeoxycholic to folic. And as you heard from the speakers before me, the microbiome could alter this. And the bile acids play extremely important role because they have two sides. One side of the molecule is hydrophobic, and the other side is hydrophilic. And this molecule that allows this molecule to combine with the triacylglycerols and ultimately form micelles. And these hydrophilic surface areas project outwards, and the micelle gets reorganized into smaller micelles after they are broken down by lipases from the pancreas and form fatty acids. A significant amount of what happens in the fatty acid metabolism is altered with the bariatric surgery. So we decided we will proceed to understand what happens with the enterohepatic circulation. Well, just as a reminder, the enterohepatic circulation, we lose approximately 0.2 to 1 gram per day of bile acids, and there is an enterohepatic circulation that probably circulates around 13 times a day. Now, bile acids, when they play a signaling role, they affect several different receptors. But the most two important receptors, one is an FXR, which is found in these various tissues, small intestine, kidney, etc., and the bile acids affect it differently. And they are extremely important in maintaining that enterohepatic circulation and either stimulating or inhibiting the bile acid formation. There's another receptor, which is TGR5, and this is also found in other tissues such as the gallbladder, etc. It's found in the CNS, it's found in skeletal muscle, and it plays significant roles in various physiologic roles. For example, the bile acids can be signaling molecules in the intestinal cells, and they produce various other what we call molecules or hormones, FGF19, FGF15, depending on which species that you're studying, or an FGF21, and each one of them has a different effect. And similarly, the TGR5 can be important in the release of GLP-1, which is important in the glucose and homeostasis in the body. So we decided a few years back to look at various diversions of bile diversions, and Randy's group had been doing in the rat model basically putting catheters from the common bile duct in the rat all the way to various segments of the intestine. And in the mouse, the rat doesn't have a gallbladder. In the mouse, we decided we would go ahead and establish a model of bypass to various segments of the intestine to simulate what happens in various bariatric procedures. And this allowed us to examine the various metabolic effects of segmented bile diversion, as well as compare alongside what happens with Roux-en-Y gastric bypass and sham procedures. And in essence, will you see on your right-hand side that you will be able to bypass the gallbladder either to the duodenum, to the mid-duodenum at various segments, and to the terminal ileum. And that gives us some kind of an understanding of the role of these bile acids in what we see in various bariatric procedures in humans. On your right-hand side, you will find the effect of mice that have been kept on high-fat diet, and those that had the sham procedure, they had their body weight increase significantly over time. But you will see that the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, which is depicted in blue, had significant changes in body weight, similar to what happens in humans, and the bile diversion to the ileum had more robust decrease in body weight, probably akin to the biliopancreatic diversion model. The food intake was identical, and that has significant implications on energy expenditure. And interestingly, the food intake never goes back to what other animals do in the sham procedure. The bile acid levels in these animals increases significantly. I won't have time to go into the various bile acids, but the one that is the most significant with the two stars in it is a beta-murucolic acid, which is similar to ursodeoxycholic acid in humans. We found out that they do decrease hepatic steatosis, similar to what happens in the in Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. We looked at various gene signatures and looked at the various metabolic pathways that end up being affected. And obviously, there is a significant improvement in glucose tolerance with that procedure. Now, I'm going to take you to a different area, an area that has sort of, Dr. Seely sort of touched a little bit upon, but show you some recent information that we think bariatric surgery has significant effects that do not necessarily relate to either body weight changes or to metabolic changes. And that is the effect on regulating the pleasure centers in type 2 diabetes and drug addiction. In the early 1990s, I moved from Vanderbilt to Stony Brook, and my lab moved to Brookhaven National Lab. To me, this was like Toys R Us. There are over 3,000 physicists in that lab, and there were only 3 MDs. And it was incredibly exciting. And the lady who headed the medical department at the time, Dr. Nora Volkow, who was the medical director at Brookhaven National Lab and has, over the past 9 years, been the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, our labs coalesced together. And we were interested in looking at the reward centers in the brain. I won't go into the details of the biochemical pathways that are involved, but the most important thing to know is that dopamine is considered to be the reward molecule in the brain. And in order to be able to measure it, we used a compound called 11-C-raclopride. This is a compound similar to cocaine, and it basically is an antagonist on the D2 dopamine receptor. And it had selectivity to the cerebral D2 receptors. We used that compound in various studies of cocaine addicts. We had addicts that we were giving them cocaine under IRB approval. We gave them methamphetamine, alcohol, heroin, and we had several of these studies. And all you have to do is look at the intensity of the red in that in those brain images. These are human studies. And you will find that the brain of the addicted individual has fewer dopamine receptors. We decided one day, is it possible that obesity is an addictive behavior as well? And we did some studies in obese subjects. And all you have to do is also look at the level of the red intensity in the image. And that tells us that the brain of the obese individual behaves in a manner similar to the addictive, to the addicted individual. Later on, I moved back to Vanderbilt. And at that time, we had access to more advanced imaging of the dopamine system, particularly with a molecule which is 18F-valipride. And it's an antagonist, but has more sensitivity to the striatal or to the reward centers in the midbrain. And we were able then to be able to determine what happens at specific centers in the human brain with Roux-en-Y gastric bypass or bariatric surgery. And this particular lady, Dr. Dunn, Julia Dunn, at the time she was a fellow in the Department of Medicine and spent 3 years in the lab. She's now at Washington University and continuing her research and is funded. And basically, she looked at what happens in the brains of humans before bariatric surgery, before the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, and 1 month later. And again, if you look at certain specific areas, you will find that there is an enhancement in the, this happens to be in the hypothalamus, the lowest component, and there is an enhancement in the availability of dopamine activity. Later on, in further studies, we were able to show that in the middle column in your left hand, you will find that there is a significant increase in the estimated increase in endogenous dopamine at various areas in the midbrain, particularly in the caudate, hypothalamus, substantia nigra, etc., around of a 10%. And this happened over a period in the first month after a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. So we decided to go back to the lab. I had a young man who was excellent in microvascular surgery, developed all the bariatric procedure models in mice, and we then collaborated with this gentleman on the right-hand side who was recently stolen from Vanderbilt by UAB.
Thank you very much.
And the three individuals on the left-hand side are the people who have just carried the work. Reddy is an MD PhD student. The middle individual, Nick, is a PhD graduate student. And Rob Flynn is somebody who's been working with me for the past 10 years. This was just published last week in PLOS Biology. And it is unfinished work, but I would like, it is an exciting type of work that's important. So what we did in these mice is we took various segments of the midbrain and looked at the brain dopaminergic tone after selective stimulation, and you will find that when we diverted the bile to the terminal ileum, that the dopaminergic tone decreased, and there is something called a conditioned preference, preferred preference, CPP. Basically, what you do is you put a mouse in a chamber that has three, instrument that has three chambers, and the mouse has the ability to move either to the right or to the left. And if you take that mouse and inject that mouse in a specific chamber repeatedly with a certain of drug abuse, in this case cocaine, you will find that whenever you put the mouse, there is always a preference to go to that chamber, and that is a functional study of an addicted mouse. So when we did the bile diversion to the ileum in these mice that have been addicted to cocaine, we found that the functional study decreased when the animals were the animals did increase their preference, and then when we treated them with obeticholic acid, which is a by mouth for 6 days, this is an FXR agonist, we found that their preference for the cocaine decreases significantly. We then, I don't have the data to show you, FXR, obeticholic acid, which is now in phase three trials for NASH, for the non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, is considered to be an FXR agonist. However, we also saw that the TGR5 receptor is extremely important in the brain, and so we went ahead and selectively removed the TGR5. We couldn't do it in the brain, so we had to use global TGR5 knockout mice, and the minute we knocked out the TGR5 globally, that we saw a significant increase in the preference. So then the question is it TGR5 that's important, but this is global, affecting every single tissue? The investigators went ahead and re-injected virally the TGR5 in the nucleus accumbens. So the animals had selective, basically, restitution of the TGR5 receptor in one of the nuclei that is responsible for reward, and we found that it reversed that effect. So the physiologic changes that we have learned in bariatric surgery, basically, we showed that there is an improvement in glucose tolerance, which is independent of body weight or food intake. It's not related to fat malabsorption. I didn't show you the data. And it is primarily mediated by intestinal FXR, and it's not at least in the mouse for the metabolic finding. It is not primarily mediated by TGR5 receptor. And again, I didn't have time to show you the data. It is independent of the changes of the fecal microbiome. However, the area that is of tremendous interest to us now is the role of bariatric surgery in brain reward centers. And Anita had mentioned that there is some evidence. It is not completely proven yet that following bariatric surgery, there may be an increase in alcoholism, but this is not completely proven. And we showed that the effect of one of these bile diversions to the terminal ileum, and recently we showed it in the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass in mice, that there is an increased binding of the bile acids to the TGR5 receptors, and that gives us the opportunity that bariatric surgery can also be important in reversing addictive behavior. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not saying that every addict should have a bariatric surgery, but at least it allows us to study the mechanisms and potentially the use of bile acid analogs that can be helped in bariatric surgery. We have started the human studies on the use of bile acid analogs, and maybe in the next couple of years we'll be able to report back whether we were successful or not. I couldn't have done it without the community that is involved and without support from various individuals and from the NIH. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Abumrad. Oops, pushed the wrong button. Well, I think there may be another session here at 4 p.m., but we have time for maybe one or two questions from the audience. If you have any questions, please approach the microphones, identify who you are and where you are from.
While people are coming, Randy, maybe I can ask you a question. I was interested in the iron data that you showed. So do you think we shouldn't worry about iron replacement after in our patients now because it's kind of a futile exercise, it sounds like it?
Well, again, obviously there are real, first of all, everybody can understand that I watch rats eat for a living, right? So any answers I have to clinical questions should be taken with that grain of salt. What is true in our hands, right, is that the iron supplementation does not undermine the surgical effects. So again, this is an iron independent effect to activate the system. What I do think is that it is not just passive malabsorption, right? It is an active system. So again, it's going to be harder to fight than you might think. And again, but you still should probably be treating iron-based anemias, right? Because those anemias are going to have consequences that probably need some level of conversation.
Please, go ahead.
Hi, Victoria Gershuni from the University of Pennsylvania. I have a question for Dr. Tavakoli. In regards to your mouse model, you mentioned quite a few, which are all very excellent and exciting. I was wondering, in terms of the ones where the mice are still eating chow and it's not just substrate delivery to the intestinal lumen, what chow are they on? Is it a vivarium chow or a compositionally defined diet?
So for our chronic experimental models, we have tried a variety of kind of diet. This is prior to the surgery you're referring to.
Right.
Yeah, we have had animals, I should clarify, we use rats, most of our mice. But we have had them on standard chow, high-fat chow. We have had high-glucose chow. We've done this in a variety of settings.
Okay. Have you noticed any differences in your outcomes?
So, not really. And I have to admit, we haven't necessarily done the acute portal infusion studies in every pre-diet setting, to be honest. So that's a good question. We may need to investigate that. But we have done different diets for different kind of procedures that some of it which I didn't show.
Okay. And then, sorry, as a follow-up, do you guys happen to look at the microbiome changes as well?
We don't. One of my partners sitting here has done some microbiome work in the human subjects, but we have not done much of that in the animals yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for coming to our session.